All right. Well, today we are in our literature of analysis class, looking at chapter 7 still in terms of the poetry. We had concluded the last class with considering all of Edgar Allan Poe's poem, and we had begun on The Winter Nightfall by Robert Bridges. But before that, just a reminder then that in the next class, by the time of the next class, questions 26, 34, 35, 57, questions 26, 34, 57, 59, and 81 of the assignment for Chapter 7 will be due. All right. Well, then let's begin with our consideration then of Winter Nightfall by Robert Bridges. Now, I had begun to mention in our last class how Robert Bridges was a close friend of another poet by the name of Gerard Manley Hopkins, but that the difference between the two was Gerard Manley Hopkins became a devout Roman Catholic, whereas Robert Bridges was a thorough secular humanist. And so we want to consider that even when we're considering this poem. And the question that I would ask is, how do you feel Robert Bridges' religious perspective is manifested in his poem, Winter Nightfall? How is it reflected?
He wrote of death as if it were the end.
Yes. So he wrote of death as the end, not the beginning, but really totally the end, right? Any other things that would be how his religious philosophy would be manifested in this poem? Death is the end.
One thing is he only thinks back of his younger years. That's what he thinks is positive.
Right.
You know, there's no, you know, where a Christian would, you know, ponder God and think about everything that God has blessed him with throughout the years and, you know, and the hope that the Christian has of going to heaven. And he's just thinking about his younger, hailstrong years.
Right, right. Because for him, this is it. So his all of his focus is on, he has his this life of his. Are there any spiritual considerations in here, really?
No.
No, it's all pretty much earthly in focus, and I think as you all have alluded to, there is a strong sense of pessimism. And why would that there be that pessimistic perspective?
Because all that he has is over.
Right, right. So this is really, you know, you can really see his religious perspective in this poem. Now, one reviewer of Bridges' poetry has commented thus, Robert Bridges was born in 1844 and educated at Eton and Corpus Christi College, Oxford. After traveling extensively, he studied medicine in London and practiced until 1882. Most of his poems, like his occasional plays, are classical in tone as well as treatment. He was appointed Poet Laureate in 1913, following Alfred Austin. His command of the secrets of rhythm and subtle versification give his lines a firm delicacy and a beauty of pattern. What rhythm and versification do we find in his poem, then, Winter Nightfall? Is there any pattern? What is the pattern?
I don't think there is any. In term, no set pattern.
There's no pattern in this poem? It's just like...
Not the poem, it's...
There's no pattern?
Well, obviously it's a quatrain, but in terms
okay,
of...
Okay, well that's a pattern. All right, so part of it is it's a quatrain. And what is a quatrain?
Four lines.
Okay, so that is one pattern we see in here.
And the second and fourth lines rhyme, of course.
All right, that's another pattern.
What's that?
The second and fourth lines rhyme.
Okay.
Okay. What holds together each quatrain, do you think? Or what is there a pattern in each quatrain? Does the first line in each sort of create an image? Or no? On the first quatrain, what is the image? That's the first line. That's the first quatrain.
The day begins to droop, so.
Okay.
And like what? The evening.
And what about the second quatrain? What's the image created even in the first line?
Is how it's getting darker and dusky and you can't see very far.
Okay, so that's the image. What about the third quatrain?
Well, there's obviously some farm engine that's working.
Okay, and the fourth?
Well, obviously there's water dripping from branches.
Okay, water dripping from branches. And then the fifth, is there? You have an image of a tall man. Sixth, a heart worn with work. And last, again, a reminiscence of an older man. All right. Is Winter Nightfall an elegy? Why or why not? Is Winter Nightfall an elegy? Of course, to answer this question, we need to know what an elegy is, don't we? All right, well, let me read a definition of an elegy. An elegy is a type of lyric poem of mourning or lamentation for the dead. Usually it expresses sorrow over the death of someone the poet admired or loved or respected. Sometimes it simply mourns the passing of all life and beauty. The elegy, a type of lyric poem, is usually a formal lament for someone's death. The term elegy is sometimes used more widely. In antiquity, it referred to anything written in elegiac meter, which consisted of alternating lines of pentameter and hexameter. And I want us to look at that aspect to see what we see there. The category can include threnody, monody, dirge, and pastoral elegy. All right, I want you to see, is it the case, in antiquity, elegiac meter consisted of alternating lines of pentameter and hexameter. Tell me what you think there.
No, it's not.
Okay, so it doesn't follow that pattern. Is there a pattern though? How many syllables in it does it look like in each first line? Have you counted?
Seven.
In each one of the first line, seven syllables?
Yes. Some of them are six. That's six, no. Somewhere, I think, six or somewhere seven.
Okay. On the second line, are they different? There are some difference, right? So it doesn't follow, what antiquity, the strict rules of an antiquarian elegy. But do you still think it follows the general contours? Given an elegy, a more modern elegy does not have to...
Yeah, this was written more recently.
Right, right. It was written, let's say, around the turn of the century, of the last century. So, is it a lyric poem which is mournful, especially regarding death?
Yes, though... Does it have to have been written after the person died, or can it be written as the person is dying?
Well, I would say typically perhaps of someone who has died, but I don't think it would be necessarily. I mean, yeah, if it's mourning someone who is in the that is dying, is this man dying here? Yeah, so I would say yes. It does follow... If I were asked the question, is this an elegy, I would say yes. Okay. Is Winter Nightfall a lyric poem? Why or why not?
Not really. Not in the sense in which the ancient elegies were.
Okay, but I'm not talking in the ancient sense, because most modern poetry doesn't necessarily follow those strict rules. According to a broader definition, do you think it's a lyric? Most lyric poems are fairly short and often personal. Is it a poem that is rather short and personal, as opposed to something like an epic poem? Okay. Yeah, I think it falls under the category of lyric poem. And remember, an elegy is a lyric poem which tends to focus upon death and dying, a dead and dying or dying person. So in order to be an elegy, it would have to be a lyric poem. What images in the first two stanzas of Winter Nightfall make clear the poet's state of mind? What are some of the images in the first two stanzas?
Well, he's, I guess, blind. Hello? No. It says the course is done, so it's sort of saying the person's life is over.
No, I'm asking images. What is an image?
Well, the sun is setting.
All right, setting sun. All right, that's an image. What is another image?
Well, it's kind of hazy and dark.
Okay, hazy darkness is another image. Any other image that's there?
It's also more rural because it talks like up the lane.
So maybe an image of a lane. And a homing wain is another image. Okay. What is implied in line... Well, no, I think I want to skip that question. Who is the figure in stanza 5, 6, and 7? Who is the figure?
Well, the man who's dying.
Okay. Yes, the man who is dying. What are the tears in stanza 7? Am I saying 7 or 8? I might mean 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. No, 7.
I guess the tears of other people. Or maybe his own. I don't know.
Well, tell me why you think what you think. It says, he thinks of his morn of life, his hale, strong years, and braves as he might the night of darkness and tears. What do you think?
Well, he needed a word to rhyme with years.
All right, let's not be silly. Why? I mean, there's more than... He just wasn't looking for a word there. Whose tears are they?
His own.
Okay, mainly his own. And why would there be tears?
Because his hale, strong years are past.
Okay, yes. All right, so his reminiscence actually... the very fact. So do his hale strong years bring him comfort or what?
No.
Why do you say no?
Because it's not like he's saying how it makes him happy to think about that. It's darkness and tears.
Okay. It actually makes him sad for what he has evidently lost and feels he cannot recover, right? And again, we get back to the idea there is no resurrection in his perspective. What symbolical use of nature is made throughout the poem then? What symbolical use of nature is then made throughout the poem?
The end of day is sort of symbolizing the end of his life.
Right. You have the what in terms of the nature, what is nature doing in this poem? Again, what are we talking about in terms of timing of the, what are the scenery?
Well, the evening, so like the night is coming in.
Evening and what else? I mean, we see it in the title, right? What evening, what else?
In winter.
Right. Okay, so they represent the evening and the winter representing the evening of his life, the end of his life. What contrast then is present in the final stanza? We've already mentioned this too.
Hale strong years versus end of his life.
Okay. So his youth versus his old age and dying.
How do you know he's dying?
What does he want to see the next spring?
That's right.
Okay. Why might the tall man want to go to a rick given his circumstances? Why might the tall man want to go to a rick? Do you know what a rick is? Do you know what a rick is?
I checked the dictionary, but I forget what.
Okay, a rick is a pile of wood. So.
Let's see. To get warm.
Yes, to get warm, because it's obviously, you know, it's winter and it's getting cold. So he's trying to get warm, even though it's cold. Based on his poem, does Bridges seem to share the perspective of the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, 53 through 57? As you might remember, that is the passage relating to death. You know, where is thy victory? The Apostle Paul is covering the issue of the resurrection. So does Bridges share Apostle Paul's perspective then? No, evidently not. Also, how does it compare with Bridges' poem compare with Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 7? Do you remember what Ecclesiastes 12, 1 through 7 speaks about?
It like talks about how the different parts of the body...
Speak up, please.
It's like how different parts of the body begin to give way.
Right. What sort of symbolisms are used there? Do you remember in Ecclesiastes 12? Does it use symbolism?
Yeah, it's like, it says that the eyes can't see it anymore.
Right, but it doesn't say that explicitly. It says it in figures.
Like windows.
But how does it, it says compare and contrast, does it at all? So there are similarities with this poem and Ecclesiastes. How would you then compare it and contrast it? How is it similar then, and how is it different? Compare and contrast.
Well, it uses both use symbolism, but their worldview is different.
Okay, but be more specific, please. Okay, so let me. As far as old age, how did it treat old age, and how did it compare that to youth?
Well, both of them sort of compared old age to youth. Because, like, Ecclesiastes started out by reminding the young to remember their creator in the days of their youth.
Lori, could you catch that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, she could not hear you. I didn't think so. You need to speak up, Calvin. Say it again, please.
Ecclesiastes begins, Ecclesiastes 12 begins by, You can go.
You speak.
Like, I just can't think because you're so upset. I can't think.
All right. Well, what he was saying was that Ecclesiastes says that basically, in terms of the comparison and contrast, the... Both are describing the difficulties of old age in symbolism. They both are very realistic about the difficulties of old age in contrast with the common plight of youth. But what is their different message?
Well, one is like hopeless, the other isn't.
Okay. Any other difference? In terms of the message that tried to get across.
Well, the point of this is more that there's not much to life, but the Ecclesiastes is more like saying that you should make the most when you're young, so when you're old, you've done something.
Just for yourself?
No, well, for God, of course.
Okay, well, don't say of course. It's because what are the first lines of Ecclesiastes 12? Remember what?
The Creator.
The Creator. So the difference perspective is humanistic versus looking to God and one's duty to God. The totally different perspective is one is simply inward looking, and the end of one's life is primarily to please oneself, whereas the end of the other is to please God, that we live to please God. So it's of a very, it's what is man's duty and focus. All right. Now let's consider James Joyce's poem, Simples. What would you say is the theme of James Joyce's poem, Simples? This is not an easy poem to understand for a variety of reasons. Why is it not easy?
It's just very vague. And of course, the first two lines are also difficult.
Why are the first two lines difficult?
It's in Italian, I think.
Could you catch that, Laurie?
No, I really didn't. Sorry.
It's in Italian. It's in Italian.
It's in Italian?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's more than what I do.
Okay, so the first two lines are in Italian. That makes it difficult. What else?
It uses lots of symbolism.
All right, it uses lots of symbolism. Also, perhaps, does it use terminology we might not be as familiar with? For instance, even the term simples, that is not, I mean, we the word simple is quite common, but simples is not very commonly used word. I'm going to skip and come back to this issue of theme. I'm going to skip to question 45. And question 45 goes through James Joyce's biography, how he lived from 1882 to 1941. He was an Irishman. He grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, going to Jesuit school. The philosophy of Thomas Aquinas had a strong influence on him. But though it doesn't mention it in this biography, he actually departed from Roman Catholicism and became more of just a total secularist. In 1904, he left Dublin, Ireland, and he went to, in the early 1900s, he went to continental Europe. And then he eventually did move back and so on and so forth. But one thing that is not mentioned in this biography, though, that is helpful in order to understand the poem, I'm going to read a section from Encyclopedia Britannica about his life. Joyce and Nora left Dublin together in October 1904.
When you say Nora, you mean the wife?
Well, it wasn't his wife. He did not become, it was his mistress.
Okay.
Again, James Joyce was a very immoral man, we need to keep in mind. He went, in 1905, they moved to Trieste. Now, where is Trieste?
Italy.
Italy. Okay, so in 1905, they moved to Trieste, where James' brother Stanislaus joined them, and where their children George and Lucia were born. In 1907, while giving English lessons to a Triestine businessman, Ettore Schmitz, he learned that Schmitz had written under the name Italo Svelo and had become discouraged. It talks about how he spent some time in Rome. It also says that when he moved back to Trieste in Italy, in Trieste too, Joyce wrote but never tried to publish a poetical short story, Giacomo Joyce, describing his feelings toward one of his pupils, Amalia Popper, whose father was named Leopoldo and whose Jewish charms contributed to the character of Molly Bloom in Joyce's work, Ulysses. The manuscript found among Stanislaus' papers was edited and published with a foreword by R. Ellman in 1968. Now, that piece of his biography is very helpful in understanding this poem. The as we said, these first two lines are in Italian, and the what they mean in Italian is the same as they're translated in English at the end of the second stanza. And as you see, it's an exclamation point there, as well as an exclamation point at the end of these two Italian lines. What does it say at the end of the second stanza, which is the English translation of it?
Fair as the wave is, fair art thou.
Okay, fair as the wave is, fair art thou. Okay, now, what does that suggest?
Is that the exact translation of the first two lines?
Well, I don't know if it's...
We checked the Italian dictionary.
Yeah, that's approximate.
O bella bionda, o beautiful, o fair girl, right?
Yes, I mean, I don't mean that that's an exact translation.
O fair girl, o beautiful girl, you know. And then what was the second line? We checked it, remember?
Right. The wave.
Si come l'onda.
Yes, o bella, I'm trying to think of each word. Is beyond a wave? Oh, beautiful.
What is come? Do you remember the come?
As. Maybe it's like.
As thou art.
As thou art.
Yes. So, again, I realize this is a rough, but basically it's saying, fair as the wave is, fair art thou, is basically what it's saying.
O beautiful girl, O fair thou art. Right?
Beyond, well, let's look in the dictionary.
I'll go get it.
I was thinking, well, even just taking the lines, fair as the wave is, fair art thou, what does that suggest is being discussed in this poem? What is the narrator of the poem discussing?
This girl.
All right, he's discussing a girl. All right, and what is he saying about the girl based on just that line?
Well, she's the one who's saying it, right?
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you're right. She sings an air, yes, I'm sorry.
Beyonda means fair. Fair.
Oh, okay, beyonda means fair.
Or beautiful, or blonde.
What is bae?
Bea, belia, or bea, is girl. B-E-L-L-A.
Oh, yes, okay.
Girl.
A beautiful girl. And then onda is onda.
I'm going to.
So the.
We should have written it down because we looked at this already. Onda is wave.
Okay, there's the wave. So onda is wave. So it's saying, again, a beautiful girl.
Wave.
Or as the wave. Okay. So, again, rough. I'm just saying, roughly, we can understand the meaning of that Italian in the phrase, fair as the wave is, fair art thou. Now, let's look at some of these let's just start at the beginning. In the terms of the first stanza, what is being described?
Obviously, some child is gathering salad leaves.
Okay, a child is gathering salad leaves. That's what's being described in the first stanza. What about in the second stanza?
God bring what part now?
Salad leaves.
Yeah.
Salad greens, salad leaves, yeah. Simples are salad leaves.
Yeah, a type of herbal salad leaves. Okay, what about in the second stanza?
She's singing at night.
Okay, so she's singing. Now it says about in the first stanza, sweet dew. Do you think that's the night? Well, no, but it says the moon. So, yes, during the night. All right. Okay, or at least before dawn, in any case, whichever. And then, so what about in the third stanza? What is being said? What is being said in the third stanza?
I don't understand the third stanza.
Okay, what he's saying in the third stanza is the narrator of the poem is basically saying he's asking that he not hear this young, presumably girl, right? Because it talks about her hanging hair. It says her hanging hair. So it's not just a child. It's a, in the second stanza, it says her hanging hair, which implies it's a girl. So a young girl. So the narrator of the poem is saying, please let me, you know, give me a waxen ear so I do not hear.
I wish my ears were plugged.
Yeah, I wish my ears were plugged. And what about his heart?
He wants his heart to be shielded.
He wants his heart to be shielded. Okay. So what does this suggest about the relation of the narrator to this young girl?
Well, they know each other, but they're not related or anything. Probably.
Is that all? But what? The very fact, if I say, you know, plug my ears and shield my heart, what is that says more than just, what does that suggest are the feelings of the narrator towards this young girl?
Consider the piece of biography Papa read earlier.
Well, he kind of likes her.
But and what is really the nature of that liking?
Kind of attracted.
Okay, romantically attracted, right? And he's saying, you know, he's trying to fight off his romantic attraction. And yes, that gets us back to this biography. Apparently, he grew an affection for this young Jewish girl, which when he was in Trieste, Italy. And that, again, would explain even the use of the Italian lines in the first portion. So, you know, the thing about Joyce, actually at the time, and there were, you know, there were more moral strictures in society at the time. A lot of Joyce's works were not even allowed to be published because of their risque nature. The very fact that he would be, you know, in some sense this is a romantic poem, and, you know, here is James Joyce, an older man, and so forth. So, you can see here, the nature of James Joyce in this poem. Okay. Now, let's move on then to the poem of Amy Lowell, Madonna of the Evening Flowers. And I give here a brief biographical sketch of Amy Lowell. She came from a very prominent family in Massachusetts. She lived from 1874 to 1925. She never married. She traveled a lot in Europe and even in Egypt. And though at that time, at the time when she lived, it was not acceptable in society to publicly acknowledge being a sodomite. There is at least some reason to believe that she was one.
What year was this, like early 1900s?
Early 1900s is when this would have been. She dressed mannishly in severe suits and men's shirts.
Wow.
She smoked cigars. She was very close to a woman by the name of Ada Russell. So this is just, I'm skipping some of this biographical description, but that in brief is what it says. Based upon this brief biographical sketch, who do you think Amy Lowell meant to describe in the person of Madonna of the evening flowers of her poem?
Ada Russell?
Yes, Ada Russell. Okay. If the above biographical sketch is accurate, what should we think of the poet Amy Lowell evaluated biblically?
Well, obviously she was immoral.
Right.
And for her time, quite rebellious.
Yeah, even more overtly rebellious today than in her day. That, you know, in our society, this has become even more common. But in her day, it would have been less common. What is free verse?
A poem that doesn't worry about meter or that sort of thing.
Yeah. And would this poem be in free verse, do you think?
Yes, it doesn't have like any rhyme.
Right. All right. So we don't see a metrical pattern or rhyme. So it's... why do you think this poet would have chosen free verse? Why did poetry in the early 20th century more commonly come to be in free verse? How should we understand it? Again, in reading
the term signifies the philosophy behind it. They wanted to be free. They did not want to be restricted by having to count syllables or choosing words that rhyme. They want their free spirit,
right?
The spirit of the poem to go through without the restrictions.
Right. They don't want the restrictions
and the discipline.
And of course, the discipline. They probably would not acknowledge they didn't want the discipline of it. Yes, it, in some sense, to reflect their free spirit. And how would you evaluate that? Because how would you evaluate free verse? If you had to write a poem, which do you think would be easier? Which do you think is more beautiful and so forth? Because it is quite common in modern poetry. And we, in analysis of literature, we've gone again from older poetry to more modern poetry, and we do see a pattern in terms of thought and literature, a dominant pattern. Not that there aren't exceptions, but a dominant pattern here.
What if you were to write a poem, which one would you write? Which one would be easier?
Well, free verse would probably be easier, because then you can just say whatever.
All right. Well, free verse is easier. And I think, just as in so many ways, deciding to leave strictures and rules and order, while it may be easier, it's questionable whether it is of as great of aesthetic beauty. Okay. The term Madonna literally means my lady. If Amy Lowell was indeed a sodomite, why might she have chosen this term for the one she adored?
Because, I guess, to her it was her lady.
Okay, that's right. It was her lady. Again, this is she's coming from a very immoral perspective, and but this is her way of saying it.
On the other hand, the term Madonna has some religious connotations.
Yes, well, that was my next question. Okay. Madonna is a religious figure. In Roman Catholicism, she is venerated. How does Lowell use this image of Madonna in her poem?
Well, she sort of venerates this Madonna of the Evening Flowers.
Right. She uses it as a way to venerate her. And to... Is this poem replete with religious symbolism? If so, what? Religious symbols and religious... aspects?
Like spires, steeples, bells.
Yeah, Canterbury Tales, the Dooms. So it is very much of a religious, it has a very much religious flavor.
It's almost sickening.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's directed towards this,
Her partner.
Okay. Well, let's now finally look at this T.S. Eliot poem, and then I think we'll stop there.
Can I just quick ask a question?
Yes.
Are you saying that the Canterbury Bells are one of the religious flavors? Did I hear that or not?
I would say that, yes. Okay.
How is that a religious flavor?
All right. Well, Canterbury. What is significant about Canterbury?
Is it where like the Anglican Church?
Yes, it's where the Anglican Church is
based.
I mean, that is where the Archbishop.
Rome to the Roman Catholics.
Yeah, Canterbury is to Anglicanism what Rome is to Roman Catholicism. It is where in Canterbury Bells, that would be the church bells.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because Canterbury is their center of Anglicanism, and so when it talks about the Canterbury Bells, it's referring to the church bells of the Church of Canterbury.
Okay. I was just totally off. I was thinking flowers at this time.
Oh, okay.
So because they talked about peonies and different...
Right.
I don't know. I thought I heard...
Well, it talks about the Te-Dooms. What it... Te-Dooms or what?
Te-Deums.
Te-Deums, however you pronounce that. It's like a hymn.
It's a hymn.
A hymn to God. So it's... I think it's referring to...
It's a song in Latin.
Yes,
that,
with a certain tune. And so, you know how sometimes church bells, they make them make a certain tune, you know?
Right, yeah.
Well, that's what this is doing.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, then let's look at this McCavity by T.S. Eliot. Of course, this, how would you say, just in terms of tone, how is this different from Madonna of the Evening Flowers? Or the other poems, or let's say...
The Raven.
The Raven, or in terms of tone, or the, certainly
light.
Winter Nightfall.
It's more light and not as serious.
Right, it's more light, not serious. It's meant to be humorous and perhaps a little bit satirical. Now, in terms of T.S. Eliot, he was born in St. Louis, Missouri. His family was very wealthy and prominent, and I believe he went to Harvard. He eventually, though, moved to... he eventually moved to England and lived much of his life in England. I think I'm not going to read all of this biography. It's pretty long here as far as his life. But... some have suggested that we combat our sadness with humor. Now, T.S. Eliot had difficulties in his life, and as with many people, but he certainly did.
What were his difficulties?
Well, as far as I believe, in terms of his wife, it was a very sad situation. It says, after 1925, Eliot's marriage steadily deteriorated, turning his public success hollow. During the tenure of his Norton year at Harvard, he separated from Vivian, but would not consider divorce because of his Anglican beliefs. For most of the 1930s, he secluded himself from Vivian's often histrionic attempts to embarrass him into reconciliation. And so he had a... in 1938, Vivian was committed to Northumberland House, a mental hospital north of London. So he had a difficult married life. Some have then suggested we combat our sadness with humor. Do you think T.S. Eliot may have combated some of the sadness of his own life with humor, such as we find in McCavity, the Mystery Cat?
Yes.
Yes.
He wrote some things that also were more...
more serious. Yes, that's true. Given the setting of McCavity, which is in England, okay, I'm not going to say why we know it's in England. That's a question that has to be answered in terms of what students write. But given the setting that McCavity is based in England, why is his title revealed in the poem's last line, unexpected and humorous?
Well, Napoleon was someone who British people would know quite well.
Yes, and what was the nature of the relation of England to... well, what nation is Napoleon related to?
France.
France. So what was the relationship of England to France?
They were enemies then.
Yes. So... Napoleon, how would the English have thought of Napoleon?
They thought of him sort of like an imperialist and an ogre.
Yes, he was their arch enemy. Napoleon was very much hated in England. they a lot of lives were spilled to fight with him. And he caused havoc, of course, throughout continental Europe as well. So he was not favorably looked upon. All right. Let me read to you here what one literary reviewer has written regarding Macavity. She claims, Lydia Venue claims, that it's a humorous parody of human society. "This Macavity is not a mere burglar or pickpocket," she writes, "like his milder peers. He is no less than the Napoleon of crime. He may be suspected of any possible mischief, stealing jewels as well as milk, stifling some poor Pekingese, a heathen Chinese among dogs, breaking the greenhouse glass. Yet this is not all that he can do. The disappearance of some Foreign Office treaty or admiralty plans might also be his doing. Eliot hurries to reassure us that Macavity never lacks an alibi. He even has one or two to spare, so his crimes will remain forever unknown." The very beginning of the poem introduces him as, "Macavity's a mystery cat, he's called the Hidden Paw." How free Eliot is here from the chains that fetter his thoughts and sensibility in his more serious poems. Is it not hard to believe that the poet who wrote this wildly funny parody of human society is the same poet who reproved man so drastically in The Rock? Now, do you agree or disagree that this poem is a humorous parody of human society? Do you agree? Why do you think it's a humorous parody of human society?
Well, it makes fun of the fact that people blame something when it's obviously humans who did it.
Right. Like what is an example?
Like when a treaty's gone astray, obviously a cat can't be the one who does that.
Right. So T.S. Eliot is even making fun of people's excuses when things go wrong, isn't he? Why do you think the line, "Macavity, Macavity, there's no one like Macavity," is repeated in the poem, as well as the phrase, "Macavity's not there"?
Because Macavity really isn't there. He doesn't exist. But it's sort of a funny way of insinuating that, while it, on the surface, just sounds like he's really special.
Okay. All right, so yes, it's a way to emphasize its message. What is the rhyme scheme in the poem? What is the rhyme scheme?
Every two lines usually rhyme.
Okay. Why do you think Eliot used this rhyme scheme in the poem?
It helps kind of make it light and funny.
Right. It adds to its tone of being light. What are some examples of hyperbole in the poem?
It says, "He's a fiend in feline shape, a monster of depravity."
Yes, okay, a monster of depravity, Napoleon of crime. So it uses much hyperbole. And what does the use of hyperbole do in terms of what function does it play?
It kind of shows that he's definitely not really meaning this.
Yes, it adds to its lightness, its humor, its his.
And I meant to tell you, he's not serious.
And it is not serious. That's right.
It's
Not serious. Okay. Why is it so convenient to blame McCavity for so many things that have gone wrong?
Humans don't then have to assume responsibility.
Right. Humans don't have to assume responsibility, and besides, McCavity is not there, right? So anyway, we see here a much more light poem, not typical, by the way, of T.S. Eliot's other poetry. When you think of one of his poems is called The Wasteland, and we might be looking at that in a future literature course, but it's very different from his more serious, and frankly, some of T.S. Eliot's poems are very, very sad. All right, I think we will close there then. We will look at Robert Frost's poems next time, and as well maybe begin, and we will, but go ahead and read the short story of chapter 38. But we will need to cover Robert Frost's poems next time. Are there any questions? Okay, well, that concludes today's class.